Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Yo, it's Robert Ory, and we're always bringing you the best upbeat sports conversations and the biggest guests we can track down on a Big Shot Bob podcast.
One of the best ever, John Sally, is with us.
Y'all didn't realize that the real killer was Robert Ory. I said it a lot. I said it, didn't I, Rob? I was like, yeah. The quiet one is the one you better watch out for. He don't get mad at anything. Uh-oh, something's up.
And don't miss the show on Wednesday the 31st as we talk to Lakers president Jeannie Buss. Subscribe now everywhere you get your podcasts and leave us a rating and review to be featured on the show.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny LaRue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Jared Dubin, talented writer. His work appears at 538, many other places, and have a fun, wide-ranging conversation. Talk about our takeaways from the trade deadline, what we're looking for over the next few weeks in the NBA, the playoff chases in both conferences, the Knicks, and a lot more. A great conversation, runs well over an hour. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Always a good time.
We are basically a week out from the trade deadline, and I always find this stretch of time, I mean, you don't want to overreact. I mean, that is a very real concern with this. But also, we have more information than we did before. So how are you kind of squaring that? Like, what has surprised you? What has kind of gone to form?
Well, I think the Magic clearly are the winners of the trade deadline, 3-0. And I think the Bulls are 1-2 since then. No, but like, it's such a short period of time. It's hard to take anything away. The one thing that I think, you know, concretely that has worked quite well is Aaron Gordon in Denver doing and saying all the right things for three games. The question with Aaron Gordon, I guess, is always more his willingness to do and say the right things for a significantly longer period of time than that. I do think that he'll be more willing to play, you know, the role that I think a lot of people that have always believed in his talent have kind of wanted for him for a while. I think he'll be more willing to do that in Denver, even if only because that's like the only role available to him. Like, he's not going to be the guy creating the offense for that team. Like, they have Jokic, they have Murray, they have Porter. Like, all of those guys are going to be trusted to create offense before they ask him to do that. The only things really available to him are like spot up shooting, screen and rolling on the short roll, defending every inch of the floor at all times, getting out on the break. And those are the kind of things that people have said, like, if he does those things as well as possible and his skill set fits, then he can be the kind of star that he's wanted to be. But he wanted to be like a different kind of star. You know what I mean? But if he does those things at an extremely high level for this Denver team, like, I think it significantly raises their ceiling. And doing that, I think we've seen with other guys within that role, doing that can make you the kind of, not necessarily a superstar, but like, look at the way people think about PJ Tucker for doing all of that stuff on the Rockets. And I think Gordon is a more skilled player than Tucker is, and more athletic now than Tucker has been these last few years. So I think if he can, you know, I don't think he's going to necessarily defend at the level PJ Tucker has for these last few years, but if he can come close to it and do a little bit more offensively, I think that he'll get the recognition he's been wanting and it'll make Denver a lot better.
Yeah, Gordon is my biggest takeaway too. And it shouldn't be a huge surprise that intuitive fit there, I thought, was strong. You know, the idea that Gordon has these physical gifts and they make sense along with Jokic, as long as there was buy-in, and as you said, there has been so far. And for me, cutting has been another important element of that. Gordon has played with a four spacing big who could pass before, but Jokic is orders of magnitude better than Vooch. And also, the defensive fit has looked very good so far. And as they continue to play, we'll see if it continues on that form. But yeah, the Nuggets have been far better than I anticipated. And that doesn't mean they're going to be this good forever, but that does mean they have been this good so far. And that is a useful data point, if not a permanent one. And I think that is important when you think about kind of where the West is going. And I think that's the kind of another piece of the context here. Is whether you want to attribute some of it to the Lakers having all these injuries and falling off, and some of the teams that end up with the best records are, you know, not proven in the playoffs in the sense of, like, you know, they have good players, and I mean, like, Chris Paul has done succeed in the playoffs and everything else, but the, you know, the Jazz and the Suns, I think they have a lot of potential, and then, you know, the Clippers are the Clippers. So I think the West is, it's definitely unambiguously more open than I thought it was going to be at the start of the year. And how much of that is more just being prisoners of the moment? You know, is the, like, this Lakers stuff, I mean, as long as LeBron and AD make it back, then they're not going to be the team they are right now, not even close to it. And I think that they can, I don't think home court matters to them. But there is more of a, even with all that, there is more of a window than I thought there was. And that is very good news for the Jazz. It is very good news for the Suns. It is very good news for the Nuggets.
I agree with that. And, you know, I don't know that we're necessarily being prisoners of the moment as we are, like, prisoners to the concept of injuries.
Yes.
Like, you know, the Clippers haven't been all healthy at the same time, basically all season. So it's hard to say, like, this is what the Clippers are. This is what we expect the Clippers to be. You know, the Lakers obviously have had LeBron and AD out for a little bit now. LeBron's still out for a little while. AD's supposedly coming back pretty soon. But, you know, you never know with his injury. It's like that lower calf Achilles area. Like, who knows what he's going to look like when he comes back? He did look like 10% off even when he was playing for most of the year. So it's hard to know what, like, even if we see LeBron and AD both in the playoffs, are they going to be the LeBron and AD that we know? Like, I think we can expect if LeBron's on the court, he's going to be LeBron. We've never seen him on the court with the exception of, like, two games against Dallas in 2011. We've never seen him on the court and not be, like, the best player in the league for, like, 15 years at this point. But it's hard to know what you're going to get from AD, and it's hard to know what you're going to get from any of the Clippers at any given time or who's even going to be on the floor for them. And then you look at, you know, I think the Jazz and the Suns have been the two best teams in the West for most of the season. And, you know, like you said, the Jazz team in particular has not had a ton of postseason success yet. I think they've won, what, like one postseason series these last few years? Most of the time they've been a first round out. The Suns haven't been to the playoffs in 10 years. And, you know, Chris Paul has had a lot of individual postseason success, not a lot of team postseason success. You know, Jay Crowder has had some more, but other than that, like, who on that team has gone on postseason runs before? Like, I don't think Campaign or Langston Galloway has, and certainly none of the younger guys there have. So just in the sense that the two teams that we thought would be the favorites have significant injury questions at the moment and in the bigger term. And then the two teams that have been the best teams throughout most of the season have questions of, like, what does this actually look like in the playoffs for them? You know, we know some of what the Jazz look like in the playoffs. I think they've been a lot better this year than they were last year. Some of that has to do with Mike Conley being healthy. Some of that has to do with Derek Favors being back. And Boyan not being hurt this year like he was in the bubble. So I do think they're a better team than they were a year ago. But I think we also still have the same questions, like, who do they have to guard big wings? Like, is Royce O'Neal up to that challenge by himself? And then what do they do when defenses switch against them? Like, is it just Donovan Mitchell ISOs for the entire game? Because if it is, that's probably not, like, you're not going to win with Donovan Mitchell ISOs against Kawhi ISOs or LeBron ISOs. Like, I'm sorry, the other team's going to beat you in that situation. So they got to have something else there. So I think there are questions about them too, you know? So it does seem like it's more open, but I don't know if it's a prisoner of the moment thing so much as it's a combination of, like, everything that has happened to the moment.
Yeah, that's a great distinction to make. And for the Jazz, so they've made two second rounds in the previous 4 years, but it's worth noting the first of those teams, 16-17, like, Donovan Mitchell wasn't even on that team. You know, there are holdovers, to be sure. I mean, Gobert was a regular starter on that team. Joe Ingles was actually a key part. Derek Favors was. But in terms of, like, the kind of the modern vintage, I don't think of that as a, you know, it's a spiritual brethren, but I don't think of it as, like, the same team or anything in that form. And then, of course, they made it the next year as well, and Donovan started on that team. So more similar to the current one. But yeah, it is a real challenge, and it is also going to inevitably, seemingly, at least at this point, because of how bunched in different places these teams are lead to some gamesmanship, let's call it that, late in the season. Because in this year in particular, I mean, there's always in the modern era, there's been a difference, a significant one, between the regular season and the playoffs for a bunch of different reasons. But it is reasonable to believe that this year, especially when you consider how jam-packed the second half is, that the regular season is going to be fundamentally different than the playoffs. And so I can imagine that teams are going to focus more on who are we playing and how are they playing, rather than I want to get the best seed possible. And I mean, the Lakers potentially falling below the five complicates that a lot. And there's also the challenge of how malleable are those things? Because you know that there will be teams that want to be in a specific place, but you can't really know that more than a couple of days, maybe a week ahead. So does, you know, Phoenix separate a little bit? Does Denver keep on this tear and maybe separate themselves? It's going to be really, really interesting.
Yeah, the Lakers thing is what I was going to mention. Like, that's going to be a huge, like, there's going to be so much sneaky tanking in the last week of the season to just try to avoid that first round matchup. And I think that might be a little bit misguided. I think you would rather play them in the first round than the second round. Like,
yeah, knowing
they're not going
to
be.
That's a really interesting idea. I used to say this in terms of the Rockets and the Warriors, like that you'd rather play, like, as the Rockets, you'd rather play the Warriors early than late, because, you know, there was this whole thing about Harden generally playing worse the longer the playoffs went on. And the idea that if they made it, that there is a possibility that the team doesn't make it that far, but generally speaking, those teams are. But the health component of this, now it's possible that we'll have had a month plus of healthy Anthony Davis at that point. It's possible. Mm-hmm. We'll have had maybe a few weeks of healthy LeBron at that point, but we also might not have. And I think that also gets at the idea, which is so interesting. Like, I use the phrase a lot of defining success, and this is a different analog, but you could think of it as the similar idea, which is, if your goal is to make the, let's say, to make the NBA finals, you're pretty much going to have to go through a similar slate. Now, there can be more extreme ones, like that year when three of the four best teams in the Western Conference were on the same side of the bracket. Like, there are those circumstances from time to time. But generally speaking, you know, it's going to be a pretty similar set of teams overall. Maybe you have a weaker, maybe you're facing a 7-8 and it's not the Lakers and they're a little bit worse. But other than that, it's going to be, you know, pretty similar. And so then on that logic, you could go to the idea of, like, you'd rather, if your goal is to make the finals, you'd rather play the Lakers early than late.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more just the injury thing for me.
Right.
Like, and I think with the Rockets and Warriors, it might have been like the Rockets specifically would want to play them when they're fresher, because it was not a particularly deep team to begin with. Mike D'Antoni was not going more than like seven guys in the rotation on top of that. And like Harden specifically was a guy who, you know, as you mentioned, tended to slow down as he went deeper into the playoffs. Whereas, you know, with the Lakers, like, you're going to have to go through them at some point, I would imagine, in the West. I don't think you're imagining that, like, you know, if we avoid them in the first round, maybe someone else beats them. Like, I don't think you can just assume the Lakers are going to lose.
It could happen, but you don't plan on it happening.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't be going around assuming that LeBron's going to lose a playoff series. That just generally doesn't happen very often. So, you know, to me, it's like, is AD still a little bit gimpy? Have they gotten their rhythm yet with AD and Drummond playing together? You know, is Dennis Schroeder still upset from the trade deadline? Like, I'd rather be playing with all that stuff hanging over them than, like, after they've summarily dispatched back-to-back opponents in the first two rounds.
Yeah, it's definitely a worthwhile concept.
But by the way, they could, like, it's not out of the realm of possibility that they drop to the play-in, right? Like,
oh, it's possible. I mean, I think that if Davis comes back on the sooner side, I think that the Lakers will be good enough to kind of tread water, because there is a decent amount of separation. So right now the Lakers are 30-18 as we're recording this. So that's 12 games over 500. The Blazers are close, but then next up is Dallas is 25-21. So that is
too far ahead.
So, like, that's a pretty big margin, and it's true. Like, if the dual absences persists, you know, let's call it another 2 weeks. Like, if that goes another 2 weeks, and that margin cuts down to, like, two or three games, then we start to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And remember, like, the Lakers, their only two wins in the last little while were against the Cavs and the Magic. This is not set up for them to, like, be great necessarily, but they have a couple games. Like, they, so let's say AD gets back in time for April 12th, they have the Knicks, which will be a different kind of challenge. They have the Hornets then on a back-to-back, but then they also play a bunch of big teams. And what I would be circling kind of as the, what might be the clarification point here, is that going later in the month of April, they play two games in Dallas, April 22nd and April 24th. Well, we don't know which Lakers are going to be available by that point, but if Dallas wins both of those, then I think we'll start to feel like, oh, and I mean, by that point, we'll be about 10 games from the end of the season. So we'll know a lot.
Yeah, I would imagine. But it's also like, does it really matter to them? Like, if they're in the play-in, like, they're not dropping to 9 or 10. Like, that's just too far.
It's too far, yeah.
Like, do we really think they're going to lose, like, LeBron is going to lose two straight games to, like, the Spurs and the Grizzlies? Like,
right, especially when you think about that, if they fall to 7, that presumably means, like, the Mavericks and the Blazers move up. And so the teams that will be the most dangerous in a theoretical play-in situation are not in the play-in.
Right. So I'm not sure it matters too much. And, like, maybe they would rather play the Suns or the Jazz than the Clippers or the Nuggets in the first round.
Well, and there's an interesting idea that having a kind of a warm-up game isn't the worst thing in the world for the Lakers if they're coming in a little bit cold, you know, like if their guys are there, that it's a game that you can work your way in. The opponent's not nearly as good as you, but starting slow doesn't sink you the way that it might in a game one against the Jazz.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know. I'm like, I find it hard to be too worried about them.
The Lakers? But, I agree. Yeah. Well, so,
but it's also just like, we don't know what they're going to look like or when, just because there's a, you know, a pretty significant degree of uncertainty regarding when two of the, you know, small handful of best players in the league are going to get back on the court, and at least what one of them is going to look like when he does. Like, I think we can pretty safely say LeBron's out there. Like, we should expect LeBron. I don't know what we should expect when AD gets back on the court.
Also, like, I mean, it's how long, even if he's right, how do we know how long he's going to be right? Like, that is a factor in as well. Like, maybe AD's playing at 100%, but he's not able to play as many minutes or something else. Like, that could be a big factor. And to use a legal term, I think of what's been going on for them as a big and important superseding intervening force. And what I mean by that is the concerns that I had about this Lakers team structurally before this season haven't truly been resolved in my book yet. You know, like, whether that's, can Dennis Schroeder carry the offense when LeBron is off the floor? Will teams attack him aggressively enough defensively that it creates seams that were not there as much last year because they had a stronger defensive foundation? How do their wing defenders look? And, you know, there's the reporting that they're looking for a 3-and-D wing on the buyout market, and good luck with that. I mean, it is a very difficult thing to find when you have the mid-level exception, much less when you have the minimum, and there hasn't been a clear, you know, great buyout player or anything like that. So all of those things, all of those concerns are still there. And I would tie in also that the Lakers are at their best when Anthony Davis is at center and LeBron's at the four. And they've thrown so many resources into other configurations. And so you wonder what Frank Vogel is going to do, how these rotations are going to work. And so obviously those are not the big problems right now, like getting healthy, getting your best players back. But those things are still concerns for me. And it's also particularly interesting because as things broke, and, you know, no shame on the Lakers, they beat everyone who was in front of them and did most of it in convincing style. But those same concerns, I thought they had better talent for a lot of those things last year, and those were not really the ways they were tested last year.
Yeah, I would say I have the same concerns that I had about them as the start of the season, and the same degree of trust in LeBron to alleviate them essentially by himself.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
You know, so it's like, in the end, it's going to come down to, like, can LeBron make up for whatever weaknesses they have, or can he not? And that's basically the way it's been with every LeBron team for the last forever. And, like, I would say, in general, the answer is almost always yes. And it's just a matter of, can he do it enough in the context of one specific series?
Something I want to jump to while we're still in the West is something that Nate and I have discussed a little bit over the last couple weeks. We actually got asked it in a chat a little while ago, is kind of comparing the Jazz and the Suns, knowing what we know right now. And so basically the way that I've phrased this, and I'll just, instead of giving it to you, I'll just pose it my way and you can say whether you agree or not, is that if you threw every Western Conference playoff team onto a roulette wheel, and you spun the wheel and you said, and you're like, okay, you have to play whatever team pops up. While there are absolutely matchups where I would prefer having the Jazz and Quinn Snyder and everything else, I think in that construct, there are more teams where I'd rather have the Suns roster than the Jazz roster.
In terms of playing against them, or which team you'd rather go with?
I would rather be backing the Suns. You know, like, I'd rather, if I had to put my chips on one team, not knowing who the opponent was, just because I think they have more defensive versatility. I think that their offense is harder to bog down because they have multiple creators and they have guys that are really dynamic. And because they have an interesting version of depth, you know, like they can go with the Saric center thing. They have a bunch of different front court guys. And the back court, they don't have a ton of different, like, table setters, though two is more than most teams have, but they have a lot of other players that can fit in the mix. And so with Utah, I don't see as much malleability, as much versatility with them. And if it works, it works really well. But if it doesn't, I'm less confident.
It's a really interesting question. Because it's so context dependent. Like,
right,
there are certain teams like I just would not want to have the Jazz roster against. Like, if you're playing the Blazers or the Clippers, like, I don't want the Jazz roster specifically, or honestly, if we're playing the Suns, I don't really want the Jazz roster either, because the two guys that have killed the Jazz style drop defense the most over the years are Chris Paul and Paul George, because they're the league's best snakers of pick and rolls, where they come around the screen and just, like, essentially back up while their man is coming over and walk themselves right into a wide open jumper that they hit every time. So I wouldn't want to be either of the – I wouldn't want the Jazz against either of those two teams. And then, like, you know, I would imagine we're going to talk about this Dame story I wrote the other day. At some point, we can sort of transition into it a little bit at this point. But, like, if you're playing anything but blitz on Dame Lillard pick and rolls, like, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, let's get to the Lillard piece that you wrote for 538. I really enjoyed it, and I won't necessarily say it focused on, but I thought one of the important elements of it was the idea of vertical spacing, not in the sense of, like, okay, where can you shoot from in the geometry of the floor, something our mutual friend Seth Partner has talked about a lot, but in terms of screen setting and the idea that setting a screen higher, while not great for every team, it opens up elements for Portland's attack that are significantly more difficult if those screens are set closer to the basket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say in general, it's not the best strategy for most teams. Like, league-wide, the things I'm talking about from, like, 30-plus feet out, pick and rolls that include those type of screens are generally less efficient than when the screen is set closer to the rim. And that's even slightly the case for the Blazers. But the way, like, the difference between Lillard's efficiency on deep screens and the league average is even greater than it is between Lillard's efficiency on closer screens and the league average, specifically because he's got the best shooting percentage in the league on those super deep threes, like deeper than 28 feet. We use the aggression plus metric that Krishna Narsu and I created last season to show that basically defenses are playing more aggressive pick and roll defense against the Blazers and Lillard specifically this season than any team in the league, and the fourth most aggressive defense of the last 8 years. And it's all because, you know, Dame is such a threat no matter how, like, he's a step over half court and he just walks into a three. There's really nothing you could do if you don't blitz it. Like, again, good luck. You know, it's over a point per possession, 1.2, it was like 1.26 or something like that, points per possession on those plays. And it's like, it's the most efficient offense in the history of the league, you know? So basically, defenses are doing all this, going all out to stop him, because no matter what he does on the pick and roll, it's so efficient. And the Blazers' answer has just been like to move their pick and rolls back even further and bring the defense even further out on the floor. And Dame's like the only guy that can make that an efficient proposition at this point, basically. So that's something where the Jazz, for example, that we're just talking about, they're not going to do that. They're not going to have Rudy Gobert blitz Dame Lillard 35 feet from the rim. It's just not their system, you know? And if they don't do that, like, okay, he's going to walk into a 28-footer, trip after trip down the floor, and it's going to be like, what are they doing? And, like, can you pull Rudy Gobert off the floor? Not really. Like, what else are you doing? It's not like Favors is jumping out there, you know? So, you know, like I said, there are certain matchups I wouldn't want them, but there are others that I might. Like, if we're going against, like, let's say you're in the finals and you're playing the Sixers, I think I'd rather the Jazz roster.
Same. I mean, there is a possibility that some of the Sixers configurations could gum up their attack, but generally speaking, I think that I think that the Jazz roster would be better, especially just because having a couple of guys to go after Embiid and just players who can affect everything that they like to do around the rim, and they have a lot of other capable defenders that aren't going to be challenged as much because the Sixers don't have those same threats like what we were talking about with our concerns with the Jazz. Those guys just don't really exist in the same form on Philly. One of the other things I thought was compelling about the piece was, generally speaking, you know, going back in the piece, you go back to 13-14, screens are happening further away from the basket, but it has been a slow progression throughout the league. But it has not been a slow progression for Portland specifically, and that makes a world of sense.
Yeah, so basically the average screen for the league has gone from, like, in 13-14, it was 22.7 feet away from the rim, and this year it's 24 feet from the rim. So it's moved about, you know, 1.3 feet back, you know, like a foot and 16 inches back on the floor, basically. Lillard's average screen started already even further away from the rim than the average screen this year. He started at 24.7, so about 2.5 feet further than the average screen in the league in 13-14. And this year, he's getting the farthest screens that anybody has gotten in the second spectrum era, which, again, goes 8 years. His average screen is coming 28.9 feet away from the rim, which is, you know, 4.9 feet further than the average screen in the league. And, it, like, the difference used to be about like, 2 feet, and now it's, like, almost 5 feet. So
yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, and if you think about it, like, there are a lot of different ways, and you talked about this in the piece with some video, that Lillard can take advantage of that, whether it's setting up teammates and having more space for them to operate, or if Lillard can, you know, get through the blitz, figure out, you know, feint, get somebody else, then he has an advantage with more space to operate. They're, like, doing it. And because in a normal circumstance, you wouldn't do it just because the other team wouldn't respect it. But with Lillard, you have to. And so that's what opens up these other avenues.
Yeah. I mean, like, when you have a guy that can pull up from that deep, it just kind of doesn't matter what you do. And so doing the most aggressive thing to make other players do something to beat you is generally the best thing to do. But even that is, like, still not good.
Anything else on the West, or do you want to transition to the Eastern Conference?
I'm trying to think if there's anything else I find super interesting about the West. What do you think of that, the Clippers, Lou Williams, Rondo deal? Like, I'm not of the mind that, you know, Rondo is all of a sudden the single difference maker for them. But I also think it kind of makes sense. Like, the thing about Lou Williams is, you know, as good as he is for you in the regular season, once you get deep into the playoffs, and especially in certain playoff matchups, he basically can't be on the court because he's such a big defensive liability. Like, it's just every single trip down the court, LeBron is putting his guy in a pick and roll until you take him off the floor. And that's an issue, you know, and I don't think it's an issue in the same way with Rondo specifically. So it's not like Rondo is the difference maker for me and, like, why they're now going to win the title or something like that. But I do think that one switch is pretty helpful.
after last year's playoffs, a way that I've been thinking about Rondo is that it's a real roll of the dice what version of Rondo you're going to get. And I don't think it's as basic as national TV slash playoff Rondo and everything else. I mean, health is a huge variable. His quality of play changed a lot during the playoffs. Like, he was so much better after the first round. But what Rondo gives you conceptually is another way to operate that Lou Williams does not. Like, I think the limitations for Lou are a good way of thinking about it, but also the idea that at his best, Rondo does a pretty good job of checking a lot of boxes while not leaving a lot of things just totally left wanting. And Nate said this for years, I think going back to like DeMar DeRozan is where he kind of articulated it the first time, of that in many ways the playoffs are more about the severity of your weaknesses rather than the severity of your strengths, just because giving opponents places to attack and everything else like that in many ways matters more because teams are so good at taking away what you want to do in the first place. And that was something that I had to grapple with last year with the Clippers. I was bullish on them and that didn't work out super well. But part of what gave me concerns was that Lou Williams could hit those points where he isn't necessary offensively and is just makes things so easy for the other team on when they're on offense. And that's not changing. Like that's the way Lou Williams is a wonderful player, but that's just a part of his story. And that's not necessarily a part of Rondo's. Now, there's also a possibility that Rondo is completely unplayable, whether that's because he's unhealthy or because he's just not fully engaged or that some of these other kind of things rear their heads. But if it's, you know, like a 1 in 3 or a 1 in 6 chance, that's something you didn't have before. And also the other wrinkle of this from the Clippers perspective, which is so different from Atlanta, is like that was something I said, is like that deal was far better for the Hawks than it was for the Clippers, just because that whole theory I just said of Rondo doesn't make sense with the Hawks and does with the Clippers. But also for the weird quirk that Rondo has a 2-year contract, and as long as Steve Ballmer doesn't care how much the team costs, sure. You know, like I've referred to it before as like kind of a second mid-level exception. Like if you just get somebody who makes around that type of money and your owner's willing to pay it, then you can use the mid-level exception on something else. And now some teams just don't spend it. You know, like that's not a luxury that a lot have. And that's one of the reasons ownership is such a big competitive advantage. But for the Clippers, it is. So I think that is an important takeaway of this experience for me. The only other thing that I'm really interested in
wanted to just quickly touch on the point you mentioned that you and Nate have talked about you know, how the playoffs is more about the degree of your weaknesses than the degree of your strengths. Basically, what the playoffs have come down to over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 years or so is, like, do you have a player who can be targeted on defense, or a system that can be targeted on defense, and do you have a player that can be left open on offense without any punishment coming to the other team? And that's, like, not the only thing that's mattered, but it's been, like, the deciding factor in most of the playoffs over the last few years.
It's a good way of putting it. Yeah, I think that's interesting. And it's obviously not as high impact as those top teams. The only other quick thing in the West is how the seeding, let's call it 8 and beyond, how that shakes out, and how the results affect teams' decision-making. That's something I talked about with Rob Mahoney last week, was this idea of interpretation. So if the Pelicans get the 9 and make the playoffs, that means something very different to them than if the Kings do it, or somehow the Thunder do it, or something else. And so how that changes the 2021 offseason, the 2022 offseason, and everything in between is going to be fascinating.
Yeah, that's it's a trap that a lot of teams fall into,
right?
A lot of times, and it's like one of the most dangerous things that can happen to a team.
When the functional difference between the eighth best record and the 11th best record in the West is very minimal, and the actual record difference might be minimal.
Yeah, I think back to, like, for example, I remember like exactly where I was when it happened. The 2006-07 Knicks moved into eighth place in the Eastern Conference for one day, and James Dolan gave Isaiah Thomas a contract extension. that kind of thing can really screw with your team for a while.
Well, let's jump to the East. again, like, to me, that one of the big takeaways was that the best didn't get much better. We'll see what George Hill does for the Sixers. You know, that's still TBD, and Embiid is hopefully coming back this weekend, so I'm excited to see him on the floor. KD, you know, hopefully soonish. So the East is, I think the East is going to be closer to right sooner than the West. But the biggest trade at the deadline for me, in terms of, you know, like, especially the treasure given up, was Vooch going to the Bulls. And yes, it was probably difficult, if not impossible, to foresee LaVine missing this time and the Bulls losing games and all of that. But it is a reminder at the same point, and this isn't why I think it was a bad move for the Bulls. There are a bunch of reasons why I think that. But a reminder that when your margins are razor thin, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's fair or not.
Yeah, and I think also, like, when you're specifically making a trade to improve your playoff chances this season, and something happens immediately after that disproves is not the word that I'm looking for. What's the word that
disproves?
Why am I, like, drawing a blank? That hurts them. There you go.
There we go.
Yeah. Then, you know, that factors in. Like, as much as it might not be quote unquote fair, that's just kind of the way it is. Like, it makes the trade look worse, even if it was not worse, you know? Like, yeah, that's...
Well, and it also, I mean, it makes it a lot better for the Magic if that pick is a lottery one. Not saying that it's going to be this, like, crazy elite pick or anything like that. But also, I mean, there's this huge dynamic in Bulls land and everything else of, you know, like, how long is this group really going to be together? And Zach LaVine has this year and next year under contract, and he will be extension eligible, and we'll see which kind of extension, because he could technically qualify as a designated veteran if LaVine makes an All-NBA team. But I think he's maybe fighting it out for the last spot or two, depending on how a couple guys' positions are defined. And if he doesn't, the Bulls, the other way that they could get a deal done outside of the normal extension rules would be a renegotiate and extend. And that requires cap space, which is less likely for the Bulls now that they made this trade. Like, that, it is, I'm not going to say it's impossible, because it is technically possible. It just would be very difficult, and they would lose some depth that would make them less likely to be good next year.
Yeah, I do think they have some cap space still to be able to do it. But I also think they probably don't want to do the renegotiate and extend. And that's pretty rare, too, right? How many guys have been renegotiated and extended?
Very few. Covington is probably the most prominent example. And there are a few others, because one of the big challenges is that it has to be somebody who's good enough and where it makes a difference, and, like, also where the other extension rules are insufficient. So you kind of need all three things to happen at once, and those three things generally don't.
Yeah, it's got to be, like, a guy who's good enough to merit it, coming off a small enough contract. But not necessarily. Yeah, it's a very narrow pool of players who would even be eligible to begin with, because most of the time you're not going to have, like, the cap space. And it's also, like, your team's got to not want to use the cap space on somebody else.
Right.
You know, and that's pretty rare, too.
Yeah, and so in some ways it's actually more beneficial if you have a modest amount of cap space, as opposed to having if you have a ton, you're probably fine to do multiple things. But if you have, like, let's say $20 million to work with, then there are a lot of teams to be like, well, we could get another player that's going to really help us a lot. So the opportunity cost of giving Zach LaVine that kind of money is much more significant, and so that can be a challenge in those as well.
Honestly, it wouldn't be that surprising if they traded for a guy to eat into the cap space so they didn't have to give him an extension. Like, I wouldn't put that past the Bulls. Although I guess it's a new management team with the Bulls, but I wouldn't put it past Reinsdorf.
Yeah, I mean, that is a circumstance that, I mean, I'm not saying that's definitively why the Bucks did what they did, but I think being hard capped, with the cap being so close to the luxury tax line, basically ensuring that a team can't have a big tax bill, I wouldn't be stunned if there were times that that was used tactically to give ownership cover.
Oh man, the luxury tax. It's it affects way too much of the league, I would say.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is such a wonderful example, and there are so many, of unintended consequences, because The idea.
Oh, you mean to tell me that something the owners came up with to work as a punishment mechanism for something they didn't like actually punished people that they weren't intending to punish?
Yeah.
That has never happened.
Never.
In the history of basketball. I can't believe that you would say that that would happen at any point.
It's incredible. And it's incredible that it keeps on happening in different ways and then just develops in exactly the way that that was always a possibility. Something that I've been grappling with in the East is you have all these teams kind of on the lower end that are all currently really close to each other in terms of record, and the lottery odds have been flattened pretty significantly. So the downside of being a little bit better is pretty muted. I mean, it's still better to, you know, if you're going to be bad, it's better to be really bad than to be kind of bad. But I'm very interested in how those teams at the bottom, defining it however we want to, how they see it and how hard they push. Like, I think Detroit's going to keep going for it. Now, we'll see what happens in terms of player availability and everything else. Like, this is not the most talented roster, at least at the moment, but probably for the rest of the year. Cleveland's a calibrator there. The Wizards are a really interesting one. I mean, Beal's missed time right now, but like, all of them are close enough to the 10 that they could, quote unquote, go for it. But what might end up just happening there is see where you are 2-3 weeks out. Just try until then and then just see where you are.
Yeah, and I think a mistake that people make when it comes to the lottery odds is focusing only on the odds of what pick you land as opposed to how low you can drop
yes,
in the lottery.
That's a great point.
That is the benefit of having the worst record in the league as opposed to the fourth worst record in the league. Just look at what happened a couple of years ago with the Knicks, where they had the worst record in the league. And, you know, the Cavs and who else was it up there with them? The Suns, maybe? I can't remember who. Yeah, it was the Suns. And then the Suns moved down again in the draft. And they actually wound up with Cam Johnson, which worked out pretty well. But that was not what originally happened for them. So the Knicks, Cavs, and Suns all have the same lottery odds. But the Knicks only dropped down to 3. And the Cavs dropped down to, what would they go to, 4 or 5, where they get Darius Garland?
And then I believe the Suns, I think, were 6, and then that's the pick that
they traded down with. And you know, the Knicks wound up with RJ Barrett, which now looks pretty good for them, you know. So that's the benefit. It's not like having the best odds at the number one pick, which is beneficial, but the actually you get is that you can't.
Yeah, and it's good to remember, and it can really affect it, and especially in certain ways in a draft where it kind of looks, I haven't studied the guys yet, but it kind of looks like there's a 5-player group and then maybe a drop off there. So ensuring that you have a top 5 pick matters more this year, arguably, than in other years where maybe the drop off was at 3 or at 4 or wherever else. So that
just
could,
don't trade your pick with only top 3 protection because you think it's a 3-player draft when Damian Lillard's in the draft and he's going number 6.
Oh boy. But let's get to the Knicks. I mean, it was interesting. You and I, the last time we talked, I think that was in late January. We talked about this idea that even if the Knicks opponent shooting regresses to the mean, there's still at least a league average defense here, and that's a remarkable success for Tom Thibodeau and the players, and of course everything else. It hasn't regressed yet, and I mean, that has been such an important part of their success now and ideally moving forward.
Yeah, I think specifically their ability to not necessarily suppress shots at the rim because other teams get a decent amount of shots there, but I do think it makes a lot of sense that their opponents finishing at the rim is not very good.
Right.
You know, they have Mitchell Robinson from the moment he stepped into the league has been a very good rim protector. He's been hurt a lot throughout the year, but when he's in, it makes sense to finish off the rim. Nerlens Noel, when he's in, it makes sense that opponents don't finish well around the rim. And even Taj Gibson, it makes sense when he's in, opponents don't finish well around the rim. So constructing a defense, like even if you allow a bunch of shots at the rim to not finish well there, it makes sense for them. The thing that you would expect to regress that hasn't yet is their opponents just shooting horrendously from 3, even though they get a ton of 3s, and they just keep shooting poorly. And like, some of that is a degree of luck, but you know what? Every good defense has some degree of luck. And if yours is 3-point shooting luck, like, okay, you know, like, although now I think, oh no, I'm looking at offense actually. Yeah. Their opponents are still taking a ton of shots from 3.
They are.
fifth most in the league in terms of a percentage of their shots, and they're shooting the worst in the league from three, like 6 or 3.5% worse than average, which is not an enormous difference in the grand scheme of things. So, you know, I think at this point, like, you would expect the Knicks are one of the, like, definitively one of the 5 to 10 best defenses in the league, which is absolutely wild.
It really is.
Like, I can't believe it, really. Although, you know, when I did Nate's podcast before the season, we did say, like, it's more likely for them to be an above-average defense than an above-average offense, which has held true. You know, their offense is still, you know, their defense turns other offenses into the Knicks offense, basically, you know. So it's not great on that end of the floor, but the defense being as good as it is, like, I think at this point, I was talking to my friend the other day who, like, we've been talking throughout the season, like, you know, if they're going to make, like, the play-in game, wouldn't you rather just not make the play-in game and get, you know, a little bit of a better chance in the lottery? Or, like, but at this point, you know, they're in, like, the 4-5-6 range more than the 7-8 range. So I was talking to him and I said, basically, like, I think at this point you would have to say, even if projection systems say some projection systems say differently right now, I think it's more likely than not that they make the playoffs at this point, because not only would they have to drop down to the play-in game, they would also then likely have to lose twice in the play-in round to not make it, because they're like 3 games, I think, ahead of where they'd have to get to the 9 seed to only lose once in the play-in round and be out. And like, to be this deep into the season, I think we're 2/3 of the way into the season, and they're more likely than not to make the playoffs just based on the combination of things that needs to happen, is crazy to me.
Like, well, there's a very funny way to know that we're 1/3 of the way through the Knicks season. The Knicks are 24-24 and have 24 games left.
There you go. Like,
I've never had math that easy to do.
Yeah, just the fact that they are 500, 2/3 of the way through the season. Like, I would have said you were crazy before the. I think I predicted them to have like the 4th worst record in the league.
Yeah, and that was a reasonable thing to do. Like, I was intrigued by their rim protection, and I was discouraged that by their offensive potential, and their offense hasn't been great. I mean, I would argue that it's actually been better than I anticipated. I mean,
it absolutely has been. They've been what, like the 23rd ranked offense in the league or something
like
that?
Yeah,
like,
they're currently
Julius Randle becoming like Diet Jokic is the only reason they're not like one of the worst offenses in the league.
Well, and that's what's interesting in terms of it's a way of thinking about value that I'm not saying in terms of like most valuable player or anything like that, but it's, you know, VORP, you know, value over replacement player. And so the idea that Julius Randle is like making the Knicks offense great, no, but he's making them a whole lot better than they would have been. And that matters a lot. And it also, like, the Randle initiation element also makes, I think, it makes their potential, like, some of their guard rotation stuff a lot more compelling. Like, I've been, like, my belief is that the way that this should go for the rest of the season and next season is that you start Barrett, Randle, and Quickley. I think Quickley unlocks some things in those units because he could space the four, but he doesn't have to be ball dominant, and that would work really well. You've talked about this before as well. And you don't have to do everything in one shot. It doesn't have to be, oh, you know, coach is too set in their ways or do all this stuff. But I do want to see it a lot more than we have.
Yeah, I do think Thibodeau is a little bit too set in his ways to do that. I do think it has been detrimental to them. I think Sharks wrote about it earlier in the season where, like, one of the reasons Quickley has been able to be as good as he has as a rookie is because Randle has been that kind of playmaker this year. You know, Quickley, if he was just like having to be the point guard really when he's out there, wouldn't be as good as he's been this year because that's not like the ideal role for him. By the way, Randle Barrett Quickley for some reason has played only 253 minutes this season.
You mean Randle Quickley Barrett?
Yeah, Randle Barrett Quickley. And they're plus 54. In 253 minutes.
Wow.
And I think on the season as a whole, they're like plus 4.
Yeah, I mean, their net rating is basically even.
Yeah, so basically they played like 2,000 minutes with that trio not on the court together, and they're like minus 38. But for some reason, played like, I don't know, was it 350 divided by like 2,300? some quick math. That trio has only been on the floor for like 15% of the team's minutes. And it makes a ton of sense just like as a conceptual trio to put those guys in position to succeed. They also just like – you can't be a good offense in the modern NBA taking as few threes as this team does. It's just really not possible. And quickly, obviously, is their highest volume – 3-point shooter. You know, maybe Bullock is catching up now that he's actually shooting the ball. But yeah, you know, like I do think that there's merit to like he's a rookie who's having success in a specific role. Like, why don't we just keep him there for now? But I think going forward, you know, if Tibbs is similarly reluctant to play him big minutes and with his two best players who desperately need shooting next to them, at a certain point you just can't give him other options that can't shoot. Like, you can't give him Elfrid Payton and Derrick Rose and Neal Aquina to play next to those guys over quickly. Like, just give him different guards, you know?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. It's unfortunate that we haven't gotten to see it as much. And there's still plenty of time, but I'm really looking forward to seeing more PJ Tucker on the Bucks. You know, just how this works, what approaches Budenholzer wants to go to. But there's still time. And so I'll lament it because I just want to see more of it, but there's time.
Yeah, I do think, you know, before we get to the rest of these, there's one more thing I want to talk about with the Knicks, which I think is it's an interesting question. So Mitchell Robinson this summer, they can either decline his option and make him a restricted free agent this summer, and then that ensures that they won't lose him. Or they can pick up his option, keep him on the roster next season at a lower price point than he would get in a contract this year, and then have him be an unrestricted free agent next offseason. And I would think at that point you're probably going to lose him because you just like intentionally kept him at a lower number for a year when he presumably wants an extension. And I was thinking about it the other day. I think I would rather just keep him at the lower number for a year and lose him for nothing after next season if you can't trade him during the year, then give him like a 15-ish million dollar a year extension. Like, look at the way that they've played on both offense and defense with him out and Nerlens Noel in there. And Nerlens Noel was available for free this summer, basically. They got him for a year and $5 million. Like, the Kings are paying Rashawn Holmes $5 million this year. Like, if you don't have a star at center, it's just not worth it to pay them big money, especially if they're not like an offensive creator. Like, the skill set is so readily available. Like, and I think that that's why it makes sense that they were poking around centers at or near the deadline. Like, I don't think Andre Drummond would have been a good fit, but there was like a brief Miles Turner rumor that made a ton of sense to me.
Oh, yeah. I'd love Miles Turner on the Knicks. Absolutely. Yeah, it's so. First of all, just as a point of clarification, there are some middle grounds. Like, it could even be something where they decline the option and then agree to whether you want to call it an extension or new contract without him going through the process. That's also a possibility. They could also pick up the option and then extend him. Like, but basically all of those could be put on the branch of pre-agreement to a contract. Like, that's right. It's just another path. The reason – so agents and general managers, like, these are the real situations where, you know, like, yeah, selling, you know, star X to come to your team is obviously more valuable. But a really important element of doing the job well is being able to calibrate based on public and distinctly not public sources to be able to calibrate a player's market. And my first blush here is that I think the Mitchell Robinson market might be less robust just because, a lot of the teams that are going to have space this year just aren't super center needy. However, there are a couple, and the Hornets should maybe be giving the Knicks cold sweats, and that could motivate them to do something different. But they're also
Robinson with LaMelo Ball. Oh my god!
Right,
I'm like getting sweats thinking about it.
but there are two things. One, I totally agree with your premise that non-elite centers are more easily transferable. Now, there is a data point against that, I would argue, in terms of Clint Capella. Like, I think Capella, that decision, I would say, from Travis Link has actually worked out pretty well. The idea that Clint Capella was better than the players that were going to be available for them in 2020 and theoretically 21, like, I think Capella has been much better. And they gave up a first, but okay. You know, like not catastrophic for them. They had some stuff to give anyway. They have so many young guys. But you are right that if, like, let's say a Mitchell Robinson offer sheet gets up to $15 million a year, then, yeah, I mean, I don't, as much as I like Robinson and have liked him going back to when I watched his high school film in Louisiana, the idea that there is a superstar in there feels faint. The idea that there is a very good, you know, like even a top 10 center, yeah, I think there's a possibility, not a probability, but a possibility. But as you were saying, basically every group of center other than the very top end up being overpaid, and you get into the other problem, which is that overpaid centers can be very difficult to move. So, like, let's say you end up with that contract.
When have the Knicks ever wound up with an overpaid center that was difficult to move, and when has that ever come back to bite them?
Never. Never, never, never. So they're not going to be concerned about this. They'll just go after it full bore. But I think in many ways the fan base is more battle scarred on that than the front office, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, but, well, obviously.
Yeah, but it is.
It's an interesting question, like, because
it's a really interesting question, and I think the point that you were getting at, which is one that I generally go the other way, but I think you might be right that this is just a different scenario, is the downside risk. So the idea of, like, okay, you get him for a minimum for a year, and then Mitchell Robinson goes somewhere else. Yeah, that sucks. You don't get an asset in return. You don't get anything else. But if you compare that to the odds that Mitchell Robinson ends up on a contract that you can't get an asset for later on, I mean, I'd say the odds of that are pretty decent. They're not amazing, but they're pretty decent. And Robinson is intriguing. He definitely has potential. He's not a certain thing in any way, shape, or form. And I mean, you know, this question is just catnip for the two of us, but it's, yeah. It is more of a question than I thought it would be. And that is really surprising. And for a player who is, like, there's volatility in his market, but I think there is at least some semblance of an understanding of what he is right now.
Yeah,
even if that's
right
not the same as what,
like,
he'll be, you know, like,
yeah,
those are
right now
questions.
He's a good defensive center who can contribute on offense through his vertical spacing,
right?
And that is a valuable player type that I just think is extremely readily available, like for $5 million in the offseason, or like as a second round pick. You know, like it's kind of like a running back. Like, you can just get that production for so much less money. And, like,
well, and
maybe
especially,
you want
to – sorry to interrupt, but especially if you have playing time to offer. Like, there are teams, yeah, that can't get that player for $5 million, but if you leave the spot open, you can.
Yeah, and, like, maybe, you know, every once in a while there's going to be a guy like Clint Capella who actually is better than, you know, what you could get for $5 million. But is it more likely that Robinson is better enough than the guy you could get for $5 million to justify the extra $10 million in salary over – two or three more years, or that you could get a guy who's like 90% of Robinson and then get like a $10 million guy who's like a better fit and can shoot and handle, which is like the things that you actually need. You know, like, it's an interesting discussion that's going to obviously determine, you know, a significant amount of their future. Like, because if they devote a bunch of cap space to him, then, like, he's sticking around. And now you got to figure out how to fit Randall, Barrett, Robinson. Like, you need to get creators and shooters out there with them, and, like, quickly can shoot, not necessarily create. Derrick Rose is the guy they brought in to create. You would imagine, since they gave up something to trade for him, they're probably going to want to resign him, but he can't stay healthy. And granted, while he's shot well so far, he's not treated like a shooter outside. He's also, like, not really a timeline fit with those guys in terms of him moving into his mid 30s at this point. Like, it's just, there's a lot of question. There's more questions than answers in terms of how to build around those guys. Whereas I think if you let him go, like, and let's say Nerlens Noel is your center, or you, let's say you're going to, like, play Julius Randle at center and switch everything. And, like, it just opens up more avenues to you. But I think, like, we've spent enough time on the Knicks for the,
well, I actually have one more just quick thing to bring up that cap space in 2021 getting a lot less valuable might mean rolling it over is more likely. And if rolling it over is more likely, then that's another reason not to spend on Robinson now. Because one of the ways you could do it is theoretically, you know, he has this low cap hold, would be use the low cap hold, spend a bunch of money, and then use Robinson, you know, pay him whatever he's going to go. And then that, you know, that doesn't count against the cap until the deal actually gets, let's call it matched in this case, if it was an offer sheet situation. And, but if you're not.
Well, it wouldn't be able to be an offer sheet because he wouldn't be a restricted free agent.
Well, no, what I'm saying is this year it would be, but so.
Oh, I thought you meant.
So if you're going to use all your space this year, then it is kind of a bird in the hand situation of like, well, what else are you going to do? That sort of a spot. But if you weren't going to do it, or you're maybe going to roll some of that over because you don't want to, the players this year aren't good, they don't fit necessarily what you want to do, in those circumstances, then paying Robinson now is a lot less appetizing.
Yeah, I thought you meant in 2022.
Right, and theoretically then you'd have full bird rights, so you could even do something like the Joe Harris deal, not the current Joe Harris deal, the one before that, where he had a low cap hold and they agreed to terms and then signed him last, basically, so they could do all these other things.
Like Kawhi when they signed LaMarcus Aldridge, sure. But then you run the risk of making a guy so angry that he sits out an entire season and demands a trade to wherever. But
yeah,
I don't think that that's as much of a problem with Mitch Robinson as it is with Kawhi.
Slightly less. What else is interesting you in the East? I mean, sorting out the top three teams is definitely compelling, but I'll open it up to you of just what's been catching your eye.
So it's the Nets, honestly. Like, to me, they're like, I don't know that they're necessarily the overwhelming favorite to come out of the East. I do think they're a pretty strong favorite. And I think what they're doing at center, while it seems strange, actually makes a lot of sense. Like, I think that they know that when it matters, they're going to have KD, Kyrie, Harden, and Joe Harris on the floor no matter what. And they're basically just giving themselves as many different options as possible to fill that fifth spot. You know, they have, like, if they want to go small and switchy, they use Bruce Brown. If they want to go, you know, small and have shooting, then they use like Landry Shamet, Luau Cabarro, or Jeff Green to still give them enough size to play center. If they want to go like big and physical, they use DeAndre. If they want to go big and switchy, they use Nick Claxton. If they need like a short roll passer, they can use Blake Griffin. If they want a guy that they can throw into the post for a mismatch, they can use LaMarcus Aldridge. Like, it's basically they're just developing like a rotation at center where they just have like they're giving themselves like a golf bag full of like all these different clubs. And granted, some of them you probably don't want to have in your bag. Like, I don't know that you necessarily really want to have the LaMarcus Aldridge club because you might be tempted to use it too often. Or like, you know, that might apply to the Blake Griffin club or the DeAndre Jordan club. But it's having them in your bag so that if you need a certain look, you have it, I think makes some sense. Like, I think that they know that their best look is small generally, and it's going to be like Claxton or Green or Brown at that spot for the most part, but it might not be against certain teams. And having a wealth of options makes sense.
I had not thought about it that way, but that is really useful. And the golf bag analogy, I think, really, even though I'm terrible at golf, it does speak to me.
Yeah, I don't play golf either. My dad and my brother play all the time. But
but the idea of, you know, having different things, and I would have loved a more wing-sized guy, but they're hard to get. You know, it's the same mm-hmm. thing we came up a little bit with the Lakers earlier. And yeah, and maybe they could have, you know, it sounds like reportedly they tried to move Spencer Dinwiddie into a deal that could have done something kind of along those lines with Oubre, or maybe there were other conversations that just haven't come out yet. Wouldn't surprise me. But it is a theory of the case that I do really like. And a lot of those, like, I mean, of course, you have your I'm not going to call them biases because Bruce Brown's been great, but, you know, fellow Hurricane Bruce Brown. And
it's a bias. You can say it's a bias.
But he's been awesome. Like, I mean, it's been so fun to see him really in a situation.
When I wrote about Harden earlier in the year, it blew my mind. The James Harden Bruce Brown pick and roll is the most efficient pick and roll in the league.
It's incredible. So having a lot of options, I mean, it does to an extent rely on those guys staying healthy, but they've also done they've been a very good team when they have it. And also, I mean,
I think they've played 6 games with Kyrie, KD, and Harden all healthy.
That sounds right to me. And also, we've talked about a lot of this context for a lot of teams. Considering the health stuff that they've gone through this year and historically, there is an argument to be made that the playoff pacing helps the Nets more than any other top-end team in the league. Because
you mean in terms of like how spread out the games are?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because,
well, that's the thing with the Lakers too.
Right. Yeah, no back-to-backs, far less travel, and so that means they can play their best players more. That means they don't have to go to use the bag as much, the golf club bag. So that could be very, very good for them. There are a lot of other teams you could say, the teams that don't have suitable replacements, but the Nets, one of the weird things that's made them so much better in the regular season, I mean, especially post-Harden trade with everything that's happened, is that you don't need all three of them to be very good in the regular season, but having all three of them in the playoffs is real important.
Yeah, and I mean, having the three of them is a good insulation against potentially not having one of them. You know?
Exactly. Especially in the regular season. And I mean, I picked their under, but that also, of course, they didn't have James Harden. Then it was a possibility, but not especially.
No, you're wrong. You got to accept it. You know, stand there in your wrongness and be wrong and get used to it.
But I'm wondering just, you know, so I think we know the top three in the East, and it's not as dramatic as the West in terms of like all of the different permutations and combinations, partially just because there isn't a Lakers in the field, I don't think, of a team that could finish fifth or worse that is just world beaters. Though, I mean, Miami made the finals last year, but so that takes some of the kind of sizzle out of the seeding drama in the East, but there is still plenty to go around there with all the teams that are, you know, trying their hardest to get there, and the ones that are that not getting there would be a real failure. And I mean, I don't mean that for the Raptors in terms of like Masai's going to get fired or anything silly like that. But even with everything they've done this year that's gone wrong, that was outside of their control, finishing below 500 is and should be a disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, they can only lose, what, like 5 or 6 more games to right. not finish below 500. So it's, I mean, it's going to happen. The drama in the East is mostly like which teams are going to end up safely in the playoffs and which are going to end up in the play-in. But like, I mean, do you think there's anyone outside that top three that's even a threat to like make the conference finals over one of those three teams? I think so.
My instinct is that Miami has the best chance just because if their theoretical ceiling is the highest, but I wouldn't expect it.
Yeah, I think, you know, if their doctors get their hands on Oladipo and he's 80 to 90% of what he once was instead of like the 50 to 60% that he's been this season, then I could see it. But I think it is going
to take a lot. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's also like Hero hasn't been as good this year as he was in the bubble. Dragic hasn't been as good as he was in the bubble. Kendrick Nunn has obviously been better, so that's, you know, a leg up for them. But they also are like, they're sort of cobbling together the Jay Crowder role with like Ariza and Bielitsa now. And it's like Crowder was Ariza and Bielitsa together last year, at least in the bubble.
Yeah. Definitely not in Memphis before that, but
no. So it's just it's more difficult, I think, for them this year. Like, and I do think like the fact that they turned at the deadline essentially one rotation player into three was probably the most impressive series of moves at the deadline. Like, they turned Kelly Olynyk and three guys that were camping out on the roster into Ariza, Bielitsa, and Oladipo.
Yeah, without having to give up a ton of assets to make it happen either. Like, I mean, the Bielitsa part of that in some ways was the most shocking just because, like, he can play. I don't think that he is the answer to any playoff team's prayers, but he can help, and that the Kings couldn't get anything for him.
Yeah, it's pretty – a lot of teams, I think, sort of overplayed their hand at the deadline. Although, like, some of it is just because if you're at the deadline and you have, like, you know, a big shooter like that, like Bielitsa, and it's like, you know, what can we get for him? And someone's like, well,
what if Trevor Ariza gets bought out and I can just sign him instead, you know? Or like if you have JJ Redick at the start of the season and it's like, well, what if I'm trying to think off the top of my head, like, I don't know, someone from, you know, I can't think of the player off the top of my head just because I don't really know who's like getting bought out in the next few weeks. Like, what if Wayne Ellington gets bought out from the Pistons and we can sign him? You know, like, why do I want to give up good second round picks for JJ Redick at that point? So some of it is like, how much do you really think you're going to get for Bielitsa? Like, if, you know, PJ Tucker is available for giving someone their first round pick back.
Yeah, that's true. I like to end them end conversations right now, but also at other points in the year with what are you really going to be watching over the next couple weeks? You know, teams, players, dynamics. What's on your radar?
Everyone's health, basically. Like at this point, what matters is like who are teams actually going to have on the court when they get to the playoffs? Like, are the Clippers going to be healthy at any point? What does AD look like when he comes back? Can the Blazers get their guys like fully healthy and integrated? CJ looks like he's, you know, back in his rhythm. Can Nurk get himself worked back up to where he was in the bubble last year? Like, can they stop anybody at that point if that happens? Or are they just going to get like roasted in the first round again because they can't get a stop? Like, are the Celtics ever going to be healthy and like put some wins together? Are the Heat going to get healthy? Are the Nets going to get healthy? Like, underrated question. When's KD coming back?
Yeah, a very basic one, but a very important one, to be sure. Point Zion is going to be something that I watch closely. I'm really interested in where that goes. This Nuggets team, you know, more time there. Let's see.
The Thunder and the Pelicans have a bunch of guys who are just like super young and athletic, and I really just want to see them play a bunch, even if they're probably not going to lead to wins. Like, I want to see more of Alexander Walker and Lewis on the court for the Pelicans, and even like Jackson Hayes occasionally, even though I'm not as high on him as some other people. And then like, show me Moses Brown, Lou Dort, Maladone, Isaiah Roby, Pokuševski. Just like keep throwing those guys on the court because it's fun, you know?
Yeah.
The teams at the bottom of the East, by the way, do not have guys like that, except like Chuma Okeke on the Magic. It's super fun.
Yeah. Chuma's been more interesting than I thought he was going to be. It's something I'm going to talk about probably at some point fairly soon. But yeah, there's a lot to kind of take stock of. We have, you know, a month and a half is the way that I would summarize it left in the season. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, man. Always a good time.
Thanks again to Jared Dubin for taking the time to come on. You can read his work all over, including the Damian Lillard Portland piece that we talked about. That's at 538. And you can also check out Last Night in Basketball. It's his work on Substack, which is great, of course, as well, and any appearances he does. And that's also a great reason to follow Jared on Twitter at JADubin5, JADubin, and then the number 5. Love having him on. And as I kind of talked about as we got into our discussion, this is a challenging moment because you don't want to overreact to things, but you also want to react to what you've seen. So it was fun to talk about all of that with Jared. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe and download every episode in the podcast player of your choosing, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, really wherever. That is a great thing to do because this show will never come out on a specific day of the week. It's just depending on my availability and guests and everything else like that. Also, word of mouth, telling other people you like it. And you can also tell other people you liked it by rating and reviewing the show, again, in the podcast player of your choosing. It's great if it's Apple Podcasts, but totally fine if it's in something else. It just helps other people find the show. Can also check out Dunked On/Dunked On Prime. Nate and I are doing one public episode a week and then four for Dunked On Prime, which is going extremely well. Love doing that process. And also the NBA cast, which is Nate and I broadcasting games every Monday on League Pass. And it's so much fun. You can watch the game and listen to our commentary and have a really great one this week. Jazz Mavericks is going to be, and that's a 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific start for those of you who are so inclined. You can also ask questions using the hashtag NBAcast. And if you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I promise I will take the time to read it. I respond when I can. I'm less good, admittedly, about that, but that's why it's input is the way that I like you to think of it. And I will take it and take it to heart because it matters to me. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.